The House Judiciary Committee for our evening setting this evening. I want to tell the members I appreciate you meeting in the evenings with us. I think until at least we get through our House bills, we're going to need to consistently, at least on a weekly basis, take the opportunity to have an additional evening meeting. So I know it's no fun, but I appreciate you sticking with it. We're going to go ahead and start with a public hearing on House Bill 2803. Do you want to start, Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2803 comes to you from the Department of Corrections and authorizes the Department of Corrections to enter contracts for the provision of correctional services to facilities outside the state. They had a law like this that was passed a couple of sessions ago that I believe sunsetted about 2 years ago.
Back in the time when we didn't think we'd need to probably do that, I suspect.
That's right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Actually, I think when we passed the law, we had crowding problems, and then we built, and then they went away, but they may be back with us.
Mitch, we're going to lead off with you. Do you want to come forward? They sent you. You were the only. You drew the short straw for evening testimony today.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. So I'm here, ready to go. I hope, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am here. My name is Mitch Morrow, and I am here on behalf of the Department of Corrections in support of House Bill 2803. The department needs this legislation to provide an emergency option, and that's critical to this conversation. An emergency option. Should Oregon need more prison beds than we can provide within existing prisons, or that we can rent from Oregon County jails? The October 2002 population forecast indicates a significant growth in our adult prison population during the 2003-2005 biennium, and we're going to get a new forecast reading in April, and we believe that that's going to support that growth. In order to accommodate the current population, the department has developed the emergency bed capacity within our current prisons. The department is currently using 290 temporary beds and 286 emergency beds today within, like I said, within our existing institutions. The 2003-2005 governor's budget provides for continued use of these beds, plus an additional 441 emergency beds within our existing institutions. In addition to that, again, as I've indicated, some Oregon counties are willing to rent us some of their vacant jail cells to assist us through this. However, even with these emergency options, it is possible that there may be a need for prison beds when we grow beyond our current capacity of these emergency beds that have been set aside. The authority to rent prison beds out of the state gives us the ability to add an option to our emergency capacity planning. Out-of-state beds would not be used unless all available in-state options are exhausted. Renting out-of-state prison beds from public entities would be the department's first option. If out-of-state rental beds become necessary, we believe we can move quickly to establish a rental bed program. Further, the department supports the Dash 1 technical amendments to House Bill 2803 to replace references to a person with an entity. The department also supports deleting line 18, which indicates that we'd release somebody that was ending their sentence. We wouldn't do that if we had an inmate out of state. We'd bring them back to the state before we'd release them from custody. So we urge your support of House Bill 2803, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thanks, Mitch. We don't have the amendments, so Mr. Taylor is going to make copies for the committee. In the meantime, Representative Ackerman has a question.
You may have addressed this while I was getting my coffee, but I was, well, he's at a late night session. I can expect more of that. You asked for capacity to enter into a contract with a person. Does that mean a private entity as well as a public entity, or does it just mean a... Can you explain that?
Well, one of the amendment recommendations is that we get away from the statement a person and do reflect an entity. We were counseled that if we left it with a person, we in fact could not establish a contract with a prison or prisons outside the state of Oregon. So that's why we went to an entity and replaced it from the current language, which says a person. And I don't know if I answered your question.
What's the substitute language going to be?
It would replace simply a person with an entity.
So it could be a private entity.
Could be. It could be. We would go to the public entity first.
Okay, that's all the questions I had.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Schauer.
I guess I understand two things from your testimony that are on the record, and I guess the question is whether we would want that in the bill or if we're satisfied with the record. One, that you look first to public entity and after that then to private entity, and then the second, this is, I understand, for emergency purposes and basically for after you have reached your capacity here in the state and including then rental beds from county facilities, that you'd be looking at this option?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Representative Park.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know they put the prison on hold up at Lakeview. It's on hold for now, the building. Were you not going to build one up there?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure where we're at on Lakeview. I know there's been discussions with the governor's office on that particular facility, and I don't know where we're at on that. I can get that information for you if you'd like me to.
Well, my question is that we're not going to substitute this for building the buildings we need here in Oregon, are we?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, that would not
this
be the case.
So what I want to be sure, and what I think you, what I think, I'm sure I've heard you testify to, is that this is emergency beds after everything else is full here. We've rented everything we can here, and then we seek this outside.
Mr. Chair, correct. That is correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Do I understand the previous legislation included a sunset and that it sunsetted? Is that what happened?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. That previous, it was Senate Bill 401. It sunsetted December 31st, 2001. So it's no longer in effect.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I was just wondering how the department would feel about a sunset on this, recognizing that this is for current and exigent circumstances, but not necessarily establishing a permanent policy. How would the department feel about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that would be something we would be willing to consider, absolutely. We had it in the last legislation. I think we could be supportive of that with this legislation.
Council?
Sure, yeah. Members of committee, on Mr. Morrow, you've changed the term person to entity. What's the purpose of that? Person is defined in ORS. The only place that I can find that entity is used, it's used in the corporate law. It basically means everything but an individual.
Mr. Chair, Council, I was informed that person did not give us the authority that we needed to go to a prison or prisons outside the state of Oregon. That's my understanding of why we went there.
Okay. Well, hello, Claudia.
Hello.
Ms. Black is here.
Claudia Black, Department of Corrections. I think I can clarify that a little bit. When Virginia drafted the bill, we had asked for entity. She changed it to person, and when I went down to find out why, she said person was defined in statute, entity wasn't. We looked at the definition of person, and we would not have been able to rent beds from other public agencies in other states. So she changed it back to entity, so we would be able to do that.
So entity is to pick up your opportunity to actually rent it not from just a person but from a government entity in an out-of-state location if you needed to, either a Department of Corrections or the state of Idaho, for example, or Texas. Right.
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Representative Jensen.
Wasn't that issue, and I don't know whether Mr. Taylor wants to pursue on that issue or not, so I would hold unless we're done with that issue.
He can come back to it, Representative.
Oh, all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is that, you know, I guess has to do a little bit with staffing, and I understand from what we're saying that the facilities are over full now. I guess my question is, are we currently fully staffed for overfull facilities?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are some additional costs obviously associated with putting more inmates in these institutions, but we believe in it's actually twofold. In some of the expansions, there's staffing that's needed, and in others, there's not. And I'd be more than happy to walk through the list if you'd like me to do that. I'll give you an example, that a dormitory that's been shut down for several years in the penitentiary, we'd reopen. It would house 88 inmates, and that would require us to staff that particular part of the institution. Another example in the same location is D&E block. It'd be a double cell situation. Inmates would go into current cells, current bunks, and that would not require additional staffing. So it's kind of a mixture.
Yeah. Can I follow?
You may.
I somewhat understand that. I guess the question is basic. Are we currently fully staffed?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I believe we are. Yes.
Thank you.
Who was up next?
Bill.
And then Gordon. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are any of the OYA facilities able to be used for any of the less dangerous criminals?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're currently in dialogue with the Oregon Youth Authority looking at a couple facilities. I think it's Burns and Prineville specifically, trying to cost out what it would whether we'd be able to use those or not. So that dialogue is going on right now.
Good. Representative Prosansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to follow up on what Representative Jensen asked. Are we, if this bill passes, would the Corrections Department look at utilizing facilities, either Oregon jails? My understanding, this is the priority, would first be Oregon jails, second, public entities outside of the state, and then third, private entities outside of the state. Is that the order of preference for the Department of Corrections?
Mr. Chair, Representative, first would be our own prisons.
Okay.
That would be number one. We would fill our own beds if we'd stack more inmates into our current facilities. We have a certain level we decided we could go to and still operate safe and secure institutions. Second would be to work collectively with, I think it's 8 counties that have come to us and said we have jail space we'd be willing to work with you on. Third, then, would be the out-of-state rental bed situation.
If I can follow up.
You may.
Is there any discussion by the Department of Corrections of not filling the staff positions that would be required to maximize our current correction facilities before going to one of the other three? In other words, is there a way of cost savings that you may pencil out that it's going to cost more for us to bring in the staffing we would need to be able to bring in another 50, 100 inmates into DOC facilities, so instead we're going to use contracts with either Oregon jails or one of the other two?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I haven't looked at it. I think that's maybe something we can go back and take a look at and provide that to you. What I'm assuming is you're talking about what would be adding staff, such as the dormitory scenario, where it may be cheaper to. I would venture to say that we could do it cheaper within our existing institutions. At least that's what it appears to be initially. But I can verify that and get you the numbers more specifically.
Okay. Claudia or Mitch, either one of you can maybe answer this question. Representative Shetterly raised the issue of the possibility of tagging a sunset clause onto this like the previous bill had, so that the legislature has a chance to sort of revisit the situation at a time when maybe we're in a better situation to evaluate our long-term relationships and our availability of beds and population. Opposed, strongly opposed, don't really care. You have a sense?
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't be opposed to putting a sunset clause on the legislation. So.
All right. Anything else?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
I'd like a little more of the history. For how long was this authority in effect before, and to what extent was the authority used before the bill, the previous bill, sunsetted?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can answer part of it. The bill was in effect from 95 and sunsetted December 31st, 2001. And I know, and I wasn't involved with it firsthand, but I know that we did use it during that time period. And I can get that information for you about how many inmates and for how long during 95 to 2001, if you'd like me to. But I know we did use it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I don't want to create a project here for where the information may not be useful in evaluating this proposal. So maybe it's just a sense about the sort of general magnitude. I mean, were we regularly sending prisoners out to other states, and if so, where did they go, or was it a situation just doing a few intermittent occasions? What was the sort of scope of its utilization?
Mr. Chair, Representative, my recollection is that we had, I want to say, 200 to 300 inmates out of state for quite a while, and I believe it was actually Arizona that we had them, and so that's about all the information I'd be able to provide you.
That's good enough for these purposes.
Okay.
For me.
Okay. Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe going back about 7 or 8 years ago, and I know Mary Blackton is smiling, I believe we had some inmates who were in Texas.
That's correct.
You'll get your turn. You're on the list. You'll get your turn.
I think we had some in Texas in one of the private prisons down there, and there was some difficulty.
That's my recollection as well. I think we ended up putting them all in Arizona, I think, in the end.
Don't you love these evening hearings?
I've been looking forward to them all day.
I know you have. I know you have. Anything else? Oh, Representative Ackerman.
One follow-up in a way, although it's a new question. You'd be exempt from ORS 279, which is a competitive bids chapter. Is that characteristic? And if so, why do you seek the exemption? 279, Section 1, Sub 2.
You know.
Mr.
Chair, Representative, I'm not sure what you're referencing. So,
but we can look into it and get back to you.
Yeah, I didn't know if it was characteristic in this type of situation, and if so, why would you want to exempt yourself from the competitive bidding process?
We can get back to you, Representative.
I'd like that. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much, Mitch and Claudia.
Thank you.
Next. Now it's your turn, Mary. Mary and Justin Wiley and Tom Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Botkin, and I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. With me is Justin Wiley and Tom Wright, both from Two Rivers Correctional Facility in Umatilla, Oregon. And actually,
can I stop you and ask a question?
Sure.
Were you guys separated at birth? I mean, was this
I get that all the time.
Have you ever toured Two Rivers? You need to have heads with nothing to grab onto.
Well, I guess.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, we want to voice our opposition to the bill as it's currently written. Let me kind of go back by saying, in 1995, the Department of Corrections had not yet had an opportunity to build enough prisons to house the expansion of inmates under ballot measure 11. And the pure numbers of inmates coming into the system created what we considered to be a very volatile, very dangerous working environment for our staff, as well as a very dangerous housing environment for the inmates. And so in 95, I actually was trying to remember which director it was, because I think it was before Person, and I don't know whether it was Michael Frankie or not. But we actually worked with the department director to give them the authority to utilize out-of-state prison beds. And we did not identify whether they would be private or public at the time. We just simply said that we would work with them to give them some authority for a limited period of time, because we felt that was better for our members and for the inmates. Unfortunately, we had very horrible experiences with the out-of-state prisons. We had fewer problems in Arizona than we did in Texas. We had horrific problems in Texas. you know, I think that the officers on both of these officers can tell you a little more detail about what happened while they were out there. But we literally had to bring inmates home in the dead of night because it was so bad. And, you know, this bill doesn't particularly give us we're just not satisfied that this bill kind of gets us where we need to be. I think there's a couple of things that need to happen with the bill before we can even consider supporting it. I think we need to define an emergency. Who decides? How is it decided that we have an emergency situation? And I think that the suggestion you tag a sunset would be a minimal kind of a position that we would want to see. And I think with that, I'm going to be quiet, let the officers talk, and then respond to committee questions, because you may have more questions that you want very specific answers to that maybe we can help you with. Or I know Jeff Sugarman has some background in this area as well.
And he's signed up, so he can come up afterwards. Who wants to start? Which one of you?
They've never done this before either, Mr. Chair, so they're a little nervous.
Well, we're in our best mood tonight, so we're glad
you're
here.
Better already. Mr. Chair, committee members, Tom Wright, TRCI. I just want to address a little bit. I really think that getting feds out of state or even taking inmates out of state to other facilities, be it public or private, would run into an expenditure of transporting these inmates to the institutions out of state and back. I know that we also run into other expenditures, as we did in Texas and other places with civil lawsuits and stuff. I think Mr. Wiley is going to speak on that in a minute. But transport these inmates is going to cost money, and I think that if you're going to spend money on transporting inmates, that we should use the professionals that we currently have working in the system. And we consider ourselves professionals in our duties and what we do. We have OYA buildings sitting empty with many beds in them, and we need to utilize those areas first. And I think that adding bed space into some of the facilities, as it was put, emergency bed space, I know at Two Rivers is one that's been looking at quite a bit. It's going to create more security and safety issues as well. I think they need to be able to use some of these facilities and use the monies that they might have to spend to transport these inmates out of state or to bring them back or where the case may be, to look at other options to try to keep these inmates in the state that they're sentenced in, because we deal with these inmates on a different level than a lot of other states do in this state. All of our corrections officers, be it officers, corporal, sergeants, lieutenants, the rank structure, go to the DPSSC Academy, get certified, and deal with these inmates on a daily basis and deal with them professionally. And as I think in the past have proven, when we had these inmates out of state, they wasn't dealt with in that exact same manner. And when they come back, they don't expect that out of us. They expect what they've had down there. We have to deal with all the contraband that tries to come into the prisons and they bring back with them, and issues like that. So that's just kind of what I want to touch on a little bit.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Wright. Mr. Wiley?
Justin Wiley, Two Rivers Correctional Institution, Mr. Chair, committee members. The one part of the bill that I'm not real fond of is, you know, the definition of an entity. I'd like to see it added in there that we do not use private prisons whatsoever. Private prisons seems like a good concept. It's cheaper cost, but they also hire substandard staffing. There's not the background checks that are required at a private prison as there are for a state entity. The inmates that were out of state during the 95-2001 period, they were housed at Denton County Jail in Texas, which was a private corporation. They were housed in Arizona. We also had female inmates in New Mexico. And during that time, I know with the female inmates, there was allegations made by the female inmates in New Mexico against the private prison staff for sexual assaults, abuse. Denton County
I don't know if it was exactly Denton County Jail, but I'm sure everybody remembers seeing the TV coverage of the inmates getting chased around the jail with a dog. That was a private prison. The abuse that goes on in a lot of private prisons is horrendous. The state agencies, particularly Oregon, I know that we wouldn't tolerate that type of behavior with our staff. A lot of states don't either. But private corporations are driven on money. You know, they're all about the almighty dollar. Some of the lawsuits that came out from our inmates being out of state in private prisons cost the state of Oregon quite a bit of money. And that's money that can be spent right here in the state to open up some of the current vacant buildings we have, such as the OYA facilities, Burns, Prineville. There's one in LeGrand. And if we were to do that, it would provide a big economic boost for those communities too, because the unemployment rate for those areas is pretty high right now because of those facilities closing. So I don't support the bill the way it's written. I'd like to see it added in there that private prisons are not an option at all, just for the simple fact of the allegations of abuse and the potential lawsuits that could, you know, that the state of Oregon could face again.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Wiley. Other questions? Representative Barker.
How many people could, I mean, how many beds are in the LeGrand facility?
If I remember correctly, LeGrand was the concept of like a juvenile work camp, forest camp area. I believe they housed 75 to 150 people there.
And would that be, I mean, would you put the same number of your people in there?
I don't see why we wouldn't, no. We have a minimum unit at TRCI that houses 96 inmates. It's the same, essentially the same size building in that. It's a way that we could use, you know, house 175 additional inmates, and the building's already built.
Right. Yeah, it was up that way. And I just want to say my concern. I mean, I want shipping out of state as a last resort, but my concern is more for you guys than it is. I mean, your safety is paramount
right.
to me. So if we can't staff them safely, I don't want so many people stuffed in ours that puts you in any more danger than you're already in. I mean, I'm really concerned about that. I don't want the working guy getting overrun in there.
Well, with those facilities that are vacant, I mean, you know, the Department of Corrections would go in there, check out the structural design of the facility, the layout, and then they would be able to provide, you know, an accurate number of inmates that could be safely housed in there, proportionate to staffing, and be able to provide those numbers.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the committee, and I heard testimony from the Department of Corrections, certainly would say that any kind of out-of-state movement would be a last resort after exploring all the other issues. And the trick is going to be, as you pointed out, evaluating the availability of these other potentially available beds because of other program closures, determining that you can staff them safely, that they're in the appropriate level of a configuration to support that. And because obviously that's going to be less expensive to everybody to keep these people here. And I think it would be our stated intent, I think, that we would want this to only be a last chance opportunity to move to move them out of state for all the very same reasons, because it is going to be less expensive. That being said, the governor's budget clearly indicated that we weren't building any additional beds in this next biennium. And we've got a staffing situation right now where we're deep into emergency beds as it is, and we're going to be deeper by the time the forecast comes out at the end of the biennium. And so this is about making sure that DOC has the appropriate tools after they've gone down that list of options to make sure they can keep everybody safe. If they need to get there. So, but we've got some amendments that I think we're going to ask the department to look at and request that they be drafted. That includes the sunset. It includes sort of reevaluating the terminology of entity and person, making sure that we're comfortable that we're talking about public entities and how that's going to work. And I'm going to at least ask them to take a look at what we heard them testify to, which was sort of their priority order on how that gets used, and developing an amendment that would allow us to, by statute, identify the priority order and how you would approach this so that we really were, and that gets to your emergency issue, I think, Mary, from a different approach, which is just that after you've ran down the list of options, you then, you know, if when you don't have any...
If they're going to, Mr. Chair, if they're going to move that way, it would be really good to have somebody to go to if they... If somebody there declares an emergency and we don't agree that there was an emergency, or if our staff doesn't agree that it's an emergency, it would be good to have some sort of an oversight. I mean, some process, somebody that we can go to call foul on.
Here's the problem. I think what you do is you come back and call foul to us eventually. The challenge that I've got with binding them too much is that I want them to be able to do what they need to do in order to make the determination from a safety standpoint of what they need to accomplish. And I'm nervous about binding them too much in a whole bunch of process or rigmarole in doing that. I think, however, if we establish a priority that they've got to go through with some rational standards in making a determination before they finally make the determination to go out of state, we've accomplished much of that. But we'll have an opportunity when we bring the amendments back to have a conversation with about it, and I would encourage you to communicate with Mr. Taylor and to work with DOC, and I'm confident, given all of our excellent working relationships, that this is something that we can at least make some progress on, if not all.
You know, we're at a whole new love fest with the DOC, you know.
Well, Mr. Chair, yeah, I just want to say that was just the direction I was thinking. It seems to me, number one, the sunset, and then number two, a statement of at least some legislative directive without necessarily constituting
a binding.
Yeah, something to sue on or be sued on, because this is something they're going to have some flexibility. But if we make clear in the statute that first we use Oregon beds, after that we use available public facilities out of state, and as a third and final recourse, only then private facility. And I wouldn't exclude that, but I would make that the, in terms of our statement, the last place to go, but still leaving them flexibility that they need to move in 7 days' time or 10 days' time to get somebody placed. They have the ability to do that. And then if there's some concern that they're abusing that, I think your suggestion is just right. That's something we look at in 2 years' time when we revisit this.
The other issue I want to be sure is that we don't hold them up in such a way that somebody can then, you know, set the market price for an available bed in such a way that takes advantage of the department's budget. So they've got to have some flexibility within their budget constraints that if a small eastern Oregon county wants to hold them up at some massive price on a per-bed relationship, that they can skip that one over and move down the list if they feel like they're getting jacked.
County in mind?
I didn't have any particular county in mind. Representative McPherson.
Mr. Chair, I agree with the remarks from Representative Shetterly, although I would prefer to take private prison facilities off the table entirely. And I realize that's removing a tool that's available the DOC would like to have available within the range of options, but there's been a lot that's been written and discussed in recent years about the proliferation of private prison facilities and the interaction between the companies that provide that service with the politics of mandatory sentencing, and there's sort of a push and pull kind of dynamic there that I would like to send a statement about in the way we craft this piece of legislation. So I would prefer to just take them off the table.
And I understand the representative's interest. I would say if you want to make a statement about mandatory sentencing, there are lots of better ways to do it than opposing a modest change to this bill on private prisons. But we ought to make our statements where we can. I think that we're having a good discussion. We'll get an amendment back and we can look at it. To the extent that you want to offer an alternative amendment, Representative, I would certainly encourage you to work with the proponents of the position you've just taken and counsel, and we'll entertain that at a work session. And we're not done with testimony on this, but Representative Przanski, feel free.
Well, if we want to wait for the other rest of the I'm going to put on the record now, I will not support anything that comes out of this committee on private prisons. I was here in 95. I saw the results of it. I didn't like what happened. I think that I'm not sure, I've not heard the need that we have to worry about going in and contracting with private entities who do not provide the service. I think if we're going to take their liberty away, we need to make sure that the people that are restraining them are trained and are doing what they're supposed to be doing. And the reality is, 95 was it? I mean, it's my birth state, that it was one of the biggest problems in Texas. And it was more than just Denton. I believe there was another set that was on the south coast,
right?
That down in Houston, Harris County area, that had another pretty significant problem. I have not heard from the department the need of how many beds we're going to need that we're going to have to go to the private. It seems to me there should be sufficient space, if not in the state, in other state facilities around this country, that that we can at least be rest assured that they have the best facilities available, and we're not going to somehow compromise the state as we did before for potential lawsuits, and in the sense of how it's at. So, I mean, I understand what the chair is and what the needs of making sure that we take care of it. Everything else I heard, I think, is really good. And I think the other thing is we are in a budget crisis, and I don't know if we should allow the crisis to dictate that we're going to get away from fulfilling our obligations to make sure this state has sufficient bed space available for the inmates that we're incarcerating. And that's my concern, my question back to the DOC, to make certain that we're not going to allow for individuals to be shipped out of state because financially it may cost a little bit more for us to fully staff to be able to have a higher capacity in the state.
Okay. Well, now you've got two.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
I'm not on the same side. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a problem in that I'm hearing from all of our counties, or a lot of the counties, that we don't have the money to pay them. So we may not find a lot of beds down the line after we fill OYA, if we can, if we can fill some of the other facilities. But a lot of the counties are losing confidence in us at this present moment. And I think we ought to leave all options open, leave the system there. You may not want to buy private beds, but I think we at least need to leave the system and the framework open so that we could if we ever had to.
I find we are, you know, we're much more dialogue oriented in an evening meeting than we are in the afternoon. Have you noticed that? I think it's because we don't, you know, we've got all night. We don't have anything we're bumping up against on our schedules, and we just feel like talking. My family's out of town. I don't have anything to go. Is there?
My wife's still out of town.
Let's see. Okay. All right. I think we're done. Thank you both very much. Appreciate you gentlemen coming in, and Mary, hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jeff Sugarman.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Sugarman. I represent the Oregon Criminal Justice Reform Coalition. While across the country, state after state seeks new and better methods of dealing with prisoners and finding better, less expensive ways to reintroduce them into society, this bill, House Bill 2803, takes us back down a path that proved to be expensive and unworkable to Oregon in the mid-1990s. There are several good reasons to oppose this bill, reasons articulated 2 years ago when the legislature decided not to reauthorize the legislation allowing the DOC to send prisoners out of state. Clearly, the experience we had in the mid-1990s should have showed us that shipping our prisoners out of state is both dangerous and expensive. In 1996, we had two prisoners escape from a Texas private facility. These sex offenders were part of over 200 Oregon prisoners placed in this privately run facility near Houston. Texas state officials said they had no idea that this type of offender was being housed in their state at this privately run facility. In 1997, two Oregon female prisoners were sexually abused by guards at an Arizona privately run facility. And another male inmate escaped from that very same facility. We can't afford the per-day cost of housing prisoners out of state, let alone the cost of a lawsuit should they be abused while in these privately run prisons. Shipping prisoners far from their families and friends makes no sense in our quest to rehabilitate and reintegrate prisoners back into their communities once they get out. I'm sure DOC officials will agree that a strong family network throughout a prisoner's incarceration gives them a much greater chance to succeed once they get out. It makes them much less likely to recidivate. Sending prisoners out of state strips offenders of their support networks. There are a number of potential alternatives to relieve any prison overcrowding problems, including several bills concerning earned time credit and transitional leave, which may be heard by this committee in the next couple of weeks. Every one of these alternatives should be explored as both a bed-saving and cost-saving measure with an eye toward what works best to reduce recidivism. We now have empty OYA beds, as well as beds in cities and counties, which may prove less expensive and keep jobs and money flowing here in Oregon instead of going to out-of-state, privately-run, for-profit prisons. Back in 97, when we had the Arizona prison problem, a story in the Oregonian reported we spent $11.7 million to house some 300 inmates in Arizona at a cost of $50 to $55 per day. Today, that per day cost is probably much higher, indeed likely higher than it costs to incarcerate people here in Oregon. In 1996, when the Texas prison break occurred, a DOC assistant director told the Oregonian, "Whenever you either rent beds or rent a prison and don't operate it yourself, you always run the risk of this happening." Has that statement changed since 1996? When we house prisoners here in Oregon, we know the corrections officials and the staff. We know the training they receive, and we know the hard work they do. When we ship prisoners out of state, we lose control over every aspect of their incarceration. I urge the committee to table this bill, consider every possible option and cost-saving and bed-saving measure, every possible alternative to sending prisoners out of state before we entertain the expense, the uncertainty, and the liability of sending Oregon prisoners out of state. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Jeff, are there questions for Mr. Sugar? All right. Thank you very much.
We're afraid.
Yeah. We're going to close the hearing on House Bill 2803. And we're going to open a hearing on House Bill 2866. No one signed up for this bill. And, Council, why don't you explain it? And I think part of it might have been that the people who may want to advocate for it may not have been watching the schedule carefully enough to see the Monday posting. So we're going to tap it in. We'll let council explain it, but I don't particularly want to waste a lot of time on it if there isn't anybody here.
On it too. This is one that I actually worked on previously.
All right, so go ahead, council, and then we'll let
members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary and allows a police officer to present evidence to basically try a case in a trial. Any trial of a violation if the city attorney and district attorney does not appear. Currently, they can only do so if by statute, the city attorney and district attorney is barred from appearing by statute.
Representative Prozan? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
If I remember correctly, this is one of those when we had some brainstorming sessions on how to save money on the system, and this is one of the ideas that came up.
Right.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is actually a bill that I worked on and had passed because we had a situation where officers were, in fact, historically appearing in court to give testimony, such as on traffic infractions at that time, and non-criminal type of situations where the district attorney or city attorney were barred from going in to present the case unless the person was represented by counsel. And so we made that change. I'm assuming council has said the reason for this change is to potentially allow for officers who want to proceed and feel comfortable proceeding even if an attorney is representing the defendant in a violation type of offense, that they would be able to present the evidence. And the reality is if you have a situation where someone's fighting a speeding ticket, they hire an attorney. Normally what happens is the officer can have the case postponed to have a city or a district attorney to come in to represent the city or the county or the state at that time to present the evidence, because everyone feels that you've got one attorney on this side, you have an attorney on the other side. But the reality is there's a lot of officers, especially traffic enforcement, who basically will walk young prosecutors through and basically do the case themselves. So I think this is to allow for cost savings, to allow officers to be able to basically conduct these limited type of cases, which are only violations, they're non-criminal, meaning the person cannot go to jail. Only thing that can be assessed is a fine.
Okay. Are there Representative Jensen?
Clarification.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they go to jail, whether, you know, whatever, is this practice of law? Is this an unauthorized practice of law, or
what?
Are we authorizing it with this bill? Several questions going together here.
Well, the representative from Eugene pointed out to me that the beginning sentence in Section 1 says, notwithstanding ORS 9160, which is the section that sets out those issues. So my answer is it would not be, if this bill passed, the unauthorized practice of law.
But it is the practice of law.
It's...
Well, to the extent that they're making an argument in a courtroom, I guess that's what you would have to call it. Representative?
Mr. Chair, the reason we made the change and put in there to allow for this clarification is because officers had routinely been going in on these traffic offenses and basically putting the case forward. You can see there are four subparts on lines 9 through 12 that gives the limitations to what the officer, he or she, can actually present to the court. There was an individual in the city of Florence, one of the police officers, who actually presented a case in front of the municipal court judge. The defendant, it was a speeding or some type of traffic offense, who chose not to appear on the case with an attorney and appeared on his own. Then he turned around and wanted to file a bar claim against the officer for unlawful practice of law. And I actually was working on the case for the city of Florence as through the department, since that's why I serve as a prosecutor. And it came clear to me that the cleanest way to take care of this was to actually make the modification that was made. I believe this was a 1999 session. It might have been 97. And so we've just clarified what has historically been accepted by the court and make sure that these individual officers are not going to be facing complaints of unauthorized practice of law.
Additional question, Representative?
Barely a comment, Mr. Chair. Far be it for me to try to do some sort of stand-in way of, be a proponent for the protection of the rights of attorneys in the state of Oregon.
And I can't tell you how much we appreciate you watching the profession. I know that the rest of the committee, I intend to teach a couple of college classes on my way home later tonight, and Representative Shetterly is actually going to pull somebody's tooth tomorrow, so yeah. Sort of know where we're headed.
Oh, you know that bill I have set for hearing.
Okay. Are there other questions of Representative Prozanski? Committee, I'm interested in your
Mr. Chair.
You've done this, Representative.
Yeah, I have done this, and like Representative Prozanski said, the only time you have a deputy district attorney is if the other person has an attorney, and that's if the officer feels the need. And then in Multnomah County, you get some law student who's, and they're interning to do those cases because the other people are too busy, the real lawyers. So I think this would be a step in the right direction. If an officer feels if John Henry Hingson's going to defend the other guy, they might want somebody to come in with him. But for the most part, on the violations, it's pretty basic. A, B, C, D, and,
It wasn't a paid advertisement, was it?
I don't know.
Representative Anderson.
Well, as a non-attorney, doesn't the client who's being cited for the traffic, they can represent themselves. I would think that on the other side, the police officer could represent the state.
And by and large, I think that's typically exactly what happens. Representative Prozanski?
Yeah, I think the other thing I forgot to mention is when you look at these four things that the officer can do, one thing he cannot do is make argument to the case to the court. The court basically has to make its own decisions, and that was the distinction of practicing law, at least from what the bar felt comfortable with in supporting the original component, as compared to just basically...
I've argued the case, but...
Yeah. No, I mean...
Right, so, okay.
Mr. Chair, are we going in more?
We're not, but I'm sensing an interest of the committee to do so. So
yeah.
Far be it for me. So we will go to work session on House Bill 2866. Close the public hearing. Open the work session. Representative Prozanski.
Move House Bill 2866 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Prozanski moves House Bill 2866 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay. Patsy, do you want to call the roll?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Rummel?
Excused.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Przanski.
Aye.
Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye. House Bill 2866 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Przanski, since it seems like you've done a lot of this, do you want to carry it?
I'll take it unless Representative Barker wants it. I mean, I'll be glad to since I've carried it before.
That's fine. Is that all right?
Yeah, sure.
You can get up and talk about your experiences in running speed traps. And
we'll both co-carry it.
Yeah. Okay. No, we're not going to do a co-carrier on this bill. You can talk about it if you want.
I'll speak for the bill.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I have never seen a bill pass out where there was no one testifying in favor of the bill in the witness statement. And that's 8.5 sessions.
This is how we like it done. I just want everybody to see. You know how easy that is? Don't sign up, and your bill moves. Okay, we're going to go to work session on House Bill 2095.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the Attorney General's office with Hardy Myers of the Department of Justice, and it's the, I guess, the omnibus bill for the Support Enforcement Division. Ronell Shankle is here, who you have both the Hand and Gross amendments, and you have the Dash 2 amendments. And I know Nancy Miller is here from the behalf of the Oregon courts, and she tells me that they are happy with the amendments, and so is the Department of Justice. And I would, for further discussion on it, I best would recommend you have Ronell Shankle come up.
Nancy and Ronell, do you both want to come up? I notice you're sitting on opposite sides of the room. I hope that isn't an indication of the
meeting in the middle.
Okay, here we go. There we are. There we are. That's, you know, isn't that what you'll have to do? You've got to love evening meetings. I mean, everybody gets a little rummy.
Mr. Chair, I hope the Chief Justice is gone for the night.
We're going to send him a copy of the tape.
For the record, Ronell Shankle, Department of Justice, and it is true, the easiest thing for you to look at would be the Hand and Gross version of House Bill 2095 with a small note underneath it which says comprehensive dash two amendments. Briefly, this was the result of many ad hoc work groups co-chaired, I would say, by Judicial Department and Department of Justice with other partners. They are comprehensive of all of the previous amendment suggestions that we had, and everyone, to our knowledge, is in agreement.
Can you just remind us of the one issue that sort of stalled all out, so we can get on the record
the
issue between the department and the Judicial Department?
Okay, Chair Williams and members of the committee, the one section that we spent the most time on was Section 3, and if you look at the proposed amendment cover memo, if you will, the two-sided single-page document, you'll notice that Section 3 is really the section that deals with what happens when we are either in the administrative process or before the courts determining whether or not to even establish health insurance requirements in a support order. And you will find in these compromise amendments that we have given all of the possible flexibility that we can to the triers and have agreed that we will still be in compliance with our federal mandate as long as we all are hearing and addressing the issue of health insurance, even if the end result is not to order initially health insurance. So that was the area we focused on, had a conference call with the federal government, several ad hoc meetings, and came to this result, which I believe legal counsel is happy with.
Nancy?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Nancy Miller with the State Court Administrator's Office. I think Ronell has explained that beautifully, and I just want to say for the record that we so appreciate the participation of the Department of Justice and everybody else in trying to resolve this issue, because as I said to Ronell, the discretion of the trier is one of the things that we do fall on our sword for, and after having the conversation with the federal government, we all felt quite comfortable that these amendments would allow that discretion to continue and not run afoul of the federal law or rules.
Okay, colleagues, do you have questions about the Dash 2 amendments that either Ms. Shankle or Ms. Miller can answer? You want to take a minute to read the section by section?
No.
I wasn't saying the amendment. I was talking about the cheat sheet that says what the sections, the one-liners that say what they do.
I just don't want to rush this through if you guys are wanting to take a...
If they can skip up here together, it has to be a...
It has to be.
All right, there you go. You missed the skipping, Representative. They actually skipped up together, so...
It was pretty ugly, Representative Sherling.
We're selling the video, though.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're in work session.
I move House Bill 2095 to the floor with a new pass.
Amendment.
Dash 2.
Representative Barker moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2095. Is there any discussion on his motion? Any objection? The dash 2s are in the bill.
Now, sir, I move House Bill 2095-2 with the dash 2 amendments to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2095 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Representative Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I noticed that or union was taken out in a number of situations. Are they then considered as the employer in this case? Or are they just being freed of responsibility for the...
I think the phraseology was used synonymously with employer, but yeah, you're not an employer of your union.
Rennell, do you want to come up and answer Representative Anderson's question?
Again, for the record, Ron L. Schenkel, Department of Justice, you were very close. You will actually see that the references to union were removed because they are actually found in the definition section of the bill. Section 2 under, let me find it, plan administrator, which is the new subsection 7.
So they're just defined as a plan administrator.
Correct.
Then. Yeah, that makes sense. Does that satisfy your representative?
Thank you.
Okay. It is still Representative Barker's motion that the bill is amended, moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Prozanski.
Aye.
Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye. House Bill 2095 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Representative Anderson, you interested in this one?
I could.
I'm trying to balance the workflow here. Anybody feeling deprived?
I'm going to start voting no to make sure that I don't.
Yeah.
Well, you volunteered the other day to pick one up, but just a day or two ago, I think, Bob. Yeah. So why don't we let Representative Anderson carry this one if he doesn't mind? In fact, it was wasn't it a support enforcement bill that Representative Jensen just volunteered to carry? So we don't want to make you look like this is all you're doing this session. So we'll spread it around a little bit.
Could you hold just for a second? We're double checking to make sure this doesn't have a substantive problem.
Oh, okay. We're checking to make sure it doesn't have a... Okay, good. All right. We're going to go then to House Bill 2207, and we're going to open a work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2207 comes to you from the State Parks and Recreation Department. Mike Carrier is here on the bill, and basically what it does is authorize the State Parks and Recreation to request the Department of State Police to provide criminal offender information about individuals. You may remember they had testimony about people in, who act as camp... counselors or something.
Volunteers. Right.
And the last time the questions we had went basically to page 5, where it says authorized agency means the Department of Human Resources, the Employment Department, or the State Parks and Recreation Department. We had some questions from Representative Prozanski and Representative Ackerman concerning the interesting term of vulnerable Oregonians, and I got the dash 1 amendments. Before you, we should have the dash 1 amendments, and I've run them by them. But we've changed Oregonians, we've deleted Oregonians and changed the persons. And then at the end of the bill, we define vulnerable person means a person who, because of physical or mental disability, is dependent upon another to provide for the person's physical needs. B is 65 years of age or older, or C is younger than 16 years of age. And the A and B come from the basically, I pull it out of the statute from dependent persons. And 16 or younger is one of those age categories that's used in the consensual sex offense statutes. They use 12, 14, 16, and 18. And I just, for a white line test purposes, pull out 16.
Okay. Why don't we first invite Director Carrier to come forward? Not that he probably has much to add, but it wouldn't be fair to make him come to this meeting and then not have a bit of sport with him on a Monday night. So this is the third try.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Mike Carrier, and you did warn me last time that three strikes and I'm out. And rather than take the attempted swing, I relied on your able administrator, Mr. Taylor, to come up with a solution to this, and I'm very pleased with the solution, and I think it keeps the scope of our authority here as narrow and as limited as we truly intend for it to be.
Okay, thanks. Representative Ackerman?
Ready for motion?
Oh, yeah. Oh, gee, we're right there. Okay, I clearly thought we were going to talk this one through.
Well, I actually do have something to say, but if he wants to make a motion.
No, we'll hold on your motion because Representative Shetterly has something to say.
Well, you know, actually, I think the change from vulnerable Oregonians to vulnerable persons is great. Frankly, I'm not sure we need a definition of vulnerable persons. We're not criminalizing anything here. This is just a precatory statement of intent or the purpose. I mean, it's not as if the state parks is going to have to justify that they're acting particularly for the benefit of people 16 or younger or 65 or older. I think this is a case where being, like I say, not a specific statute where we're proscribing any particular conduct that we need definition for. I think we could do without lines 4 through 9 of the dash one. I mean, they're not harmful, but I think they're just surplus because it really doesn't define anything for any particular purpose.
I guess I would just say that I think one of the things that has been a concern is these criminal background checks are the access to them is expanded. Is people's concern that they not just be open for any purpose, that you have to have a rational basis to sort of get yourself into the criminal background check area. And I think the intent, as I understood it from the department, was that they had particular individuals who were in their parks working with certain populations that they felt justified their need and even from a liability purpose, maybe even their essential requirement that they do some necessary background work to make a determination. And so the people who are nervous about sort of the growing ability to get your hands on a criminal background check are probably going to be pleased with at least some setting of goalposts around which you justify your ability to get it, and that you don't get it if it's somebody whose entire job is to do something that has no contact with these individuals from a volunteer capacity. That would be the rationale, I think, for at least establishing a framework that gets you into it. But
Mr. Chair,
I can go either way, but I think that's the rationale for trying to define it.
I think actually you raised the question in my mind anyway, in that then will the parks or actually any other agency that comes under this have to demonstrate that the person for whom they are seeking the background check will be someone who is expected to come in contact with this particular definition of vulnerable persons? And if that's the case, are we actually narrowing their ability to use these background checks? I don't know.
It's a fair question.
I'm just not sure we need it.
Mr. Carey?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe it does. And as I look through the existing statute, I see that once we have this authority, there is a duty to establish by rule some very specific criteria upon which we will base our decision to make a background check, which categories of employees or volunteers that we would conduct these checks for, and the criteria upon which we'd make decisions about their employment or a decision not to employ them.
You could see a rationale, for example, and I'll just use this as an example. Somebody that the department has who's a volunteer who comes in to a department office never has any contact with anybody that would be defined under the statute as a vulnerable Oregonian, licks stamps or puts on labels for some mailing that the department is potentially putting out for a particular issue, but never comes in contact with somebody defined in this group, may not require that they do a background check on that kind of an individual. On the other hand, you've got somebody who may be voluntarily going around and helping pick up garbage at a park facility, who isn't necessarily working with the vulnerable people, but would come in contact with them in a way that would allow them to do a background check on the garbage collector or the person who's, you know, doing trash or recycling or something like that. So I'm not sure that it really binds them all that much, but we'll take some direction from the director. Representative Jensen?
I think Representative Ackerman had his.
Oh, I think he wanted to make a motion.
Well, I had a point I wanted to make. I'll try to make it, because there's some irony here that I ask for a definition of a vulnerable person and find that the amendment deems me as a vulnerable person as being over 65 years or older.
Should the background check be administered to the chair here?
Well, I was going to substitute language and put in a member of the Legislative Assembly. But
right. Let's just say if we would have ran a background check on Bob, he wouldn't have got here in the first place. So.
I thought he was going to declare self-interest in this bill.
I would end up carrying it. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think it is, actually. Okay. Anybody else? Representative Benson.
I share Representative Shetterly's concern with this, and I worry a little bit about the limitations that we've placed on here that might come back to bite us. I'm not going to stand in the way of it, but I would like to have it on the record that I share the concern over that.
Okay. I don't want the committee to get the sense that I'm driving this particular amendment. We drafted the amendment specifically in an effort, I think, to try to address concerns that the committee had raised. If the committee wants to. If a majority of the committee wants to eliminate lines 5 through 9 or 4 through 9 and just change the word Oregonian to person in the amendment, we could do that.
Take out vulnerable?
Well, vulnerable. Yeah, vulnerable would stay, I think, wouldn't it?
We take out the definition?
Yeah. But you just remove the definition. But, I'm not sure this is as limiting as I think it's going to give them the flexibility that they need to do what they need to do.
Anybody who works in a state park would fall under that.
Absolutely. It seems to me,
And I think you're right. People, just because they're paranoid doesn't mean somebody isn't out to get them, but I think this might help some people that are overly paranoid about background checks.
Right. Just about sort of the broadening expansion with no limitation on when you get access to them, I guess. But I could go either way, but I'm happy to follow the sense of the committee on this one. And I know that poor Mr. Carrier is worried that if he doesn't get this bill out tonight, he's done. So,
Mr. Chair,
yes,
may I offer a perspective, because in fairness to the other two departments that have been previously served by this statute, Human Services and Employment Department. I don't know if I haven't had a conversation with them about would these definitions limit their application of this authority that they've had, and so eliminating the definition appears to me that it would retain whatever authority if it was different than that. And I noticed that throughout the statute it refers to simply persons. I'm going to lose the place now, but they're to the three categories that are defined here. But not with the specific limitations of age or physical or mental disability. I think it just refers to persons with disabilities, the elderly, and to children.
Got it. You're okay with cutting it?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay. I think it's particularly apt in light of his comments about
the employment part is what hangs me up now after Mr. Carrier said what he said, because I'm looking at who it currently is limited to. DHS, I think, would be fine with the definition that's here, but I really am concerned with the employment department because they're going to be much broader population they're going to be looking at.
Okay. Well, I think then what we'll go ahead and do, since we're in work session and I'm getting a sense of the committee's position, is that first I'll move for suspension of the rules to make a conceptual amendment to the Dash 1 amendments for House Bill 2207. Is there any objection on my motion to suspend the rules? Hearing none, the rules are suspended.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I move that we conceptually amend the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2207 by deleting lines 4 through 9.
Representative Shetterly moves that we conceptually amend the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2207 by deleting lines 4 through 9. Is there any discussion on that motion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the amendment has been conceptually amended.
Mr. Chair.
Now, Representative Ackerman was going to move.
Yeah, okay, well, then you go ahead.
He's going to carry it, so.
Yes, I then move House Bill 220.
Got to get the ones into the bill now.
Oh, yeah, got to go one in. Okay, I move that the committee adopt the Dash 1. It's not the Dash 1 amendments as amended?
As conceptually amended.
As conceptually amended into House Bill 2207.
Representative Ackerman moves that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments as conceptually amended into House Bill 2207. Is there any discussion on his motion? Any objection? Hearing none, the bill is amended. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I'll move House Bill 2207 as amended conceptually to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman moves House Bill 2207 is conceptually amended to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion on that motion? Go ahead and call the roll, Patsy.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative
Brzezinski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Wood?
Aye. House Bill 2207 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Ackerman to carry.
I'll accept that as my penalty for over-lawyering lawyering this bill.
Oh,
no.
And,
who's here?
And okay.
Am I just
time
for a question.
Can we just briefly, committee, for the benefit of Representative Crummell, I move suspension of the rules to allow Representative Crummell to vote on House Bills 2866 and to reopen that work session. Representative Crummell, how do you vote?
Do I have to? I'll vote aye.
Okay. That was a good guess. I now move that we suspend the rules and reopen a work session to allow Representative Crummell to vote on House Bill 2095. Is there any objection? Hearing none. Representative Crummell, what's your poison on 2095?
Aye.
Okay.
Two for two.
And finally, the chair would move suspension of the rules to reopen the work session on House Bill 2207 to allow Representative Crummell to cast his vote. Representative Crummell. We conceptually amended the Dash 1 amendments, Representative Crummell.
Oh, yes, I heard that on TV. I'll take another guess and vote aye.
Ha! We got him!
3 for 3, Representative Crummell.
Got me on the record now, don't you?
Representative Crummell votes aye. And thank you, committee, for your work tonight, and we are adjourned.
Oh, I didn't know.